I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Testifying before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees yesterday, former special counsel Robert Mueller said his investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election, the welcoming response of the Trump campaign, and President Trump's attempt to impede the probe was not a witch hunt, not a hoax. Mueller said Trump's praising WikiLeaks was problematic and boosted what is and should be illegal activity. He said the president wasn't always truthful, answering written questions posed by his investigative team. Mueller also warned that Russia is still interfering with our election system. Mueller's halting and evasive performance, though, and apparent unfamiliarity with parts of the Mueller report clearly did not live up to the hype and the hope from Democrats that Mueller's testimony would pave the way to an impeachment hearing. We have a few clips from yesterday's hearing queued up, and we asked Ron Elving to join us. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR. In fact, joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. And Ron Elving, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
What was your takeaway from the 6 hours of yesterday's testimony?
If your expectations were high, you were disappointed. If your expectations were low, they were met. It was another disappointment for Democrats who have counted on Robert Mueller to be an avenging angel and to swing a great light sword and somehow slay the dragon of Donald Trump. That he did not see as his mission. He has never seen it as his mission, and he was a reluctant witness yesterday. To put it mildly, he seemed almost under duress in being there, seemed most uncomfortable in being there, and most uncomfortable in trying to balance all the demands that were being placed on him, not only by the people in those hearing rooms or the expectations of people watching on television, but also the demands placed on him by Attorney General William Barr, to whom he gave his report.
Well, and Representative Schiff had said before yesterday's hearing, we want Mueller to bring it, meaning the report, to life. Do you think, Ron, looking back on what happened yesterday, from the Democrats' perspective, because they frankly are trying to figure out how to impeach the president, that it was a mistake to put Mueller into this predicament, in a sense?
There really was not an alternative. If you are going to try to highlight the findings of this report, you have to vivify them with the person whose name is associated with it when no one else's is. I mean, you can put William Barr on the stand, as they have done, or call him in to testify, and he will essentially give you his version of it, which is at odds with what's actually in the report and at odds with what Robert Mueller has said about it. So they were hoping Robert Mueller would be somewhat more vivid in those disagreements. He kept referring merely to the letter he wrote disagreeing with Barr. And they hoped that he would be more powerful in animating it. Unfortunately, he did not even want to read from it on camera, whether he was trying to avoid difficulties with reading, and he did appear to be using something to make larger the type on his screen, or whether he simply didn't want to provide video moments that might go viral for the Democrats. Either way, he didn't want to do it.
Were they expecting a different Robert Mueller?
They might have been expecting something more like the Robert Mueller they saw 20, 25 years ago, or in most of his appearances. This is like his 90th time testifying before a congressional committee, so he certainly wasn't a neophyte. But at the same time, this was unlike any other time that he came in to testify, say, as FBI director, when he was quite confident of what he was doing and trying to protect the country after 9/11. This was quite a different animal, and he did not want to be there, and he was highly cross-purposed.
Well, let me play one of the clips, and this is from the morning. This is Representative Ted Lieu, Democrat of California, questioning Robert Mueller during this testimony for the House Judiciary Committee, having to do with a policy from the Justice Department, the OLC policy. Let's give it a listen.
So to recap what we've heard, we have heard today that the president ordered former White House counsel Don McGahn to fire you. The president ordered Don McGahn to then cover that up and create a false paper trail. And now we've heard the president ordered Corey Lewandowski to tell Jeff Sessions to limit your investigation so that you stop investigating the president. I believe a reasonable person looking at these facts could conclude that all three elements of the crime of obstruction of justice have been met. And I'd like to ask you, the reason, again, that you did not indict Donald Trump is because of OLC opinion stating that you cannot indict a sitting president, correct?
That is correct.
Now, in the afternoon, Mueller said that is not the correct way to say it. We did not reach a determination as to whether the president committed a crime. Can you help deconstruct some of this for us, Ron? And let me add one more thing. When Mueller had made his press hearing a month or so ago, he said, if we were sure Trump committed no crimes, we would have said so. So I feel like we're lost in this linguistic mess.
Yes, we are. And it is a linguistic and legalistic mess because Mueller said very possibly what he really thinks in answering Congressman Liu. He said, yep, the reason we didn't indict him was because we knew from the outset we couldn't indict him. So the point here is, did he restrain a power he would have had, or did he never have the power to do so? And when he came back for the correction in the afternoon, he was – it's a small thing, but of course, it did give President Trump an opportunity to say that Mueller had walked his testimony back. He didn't do that quite. What he said was the right way to say it is that we did not reach a decision with respect to indictment.
And this is where specific words matter, although later in the hearing in the afternoon, he said that when Trump leaves office, he could be indicted.
Yes, indeed. And the president was asked about that and said, well, nothing was done wrong, so I'm not worried about it. There is every possibility the president is worried about it. And if there were a different administration with a different Department of Justice and a different attorney general, I think the facts that are laid out and laid out quite clearly and not disputed in Robert Mueller's report, as was discussed extensively yesterday, would provide the elements for a charge of obstruction of justice. So if he is not immune from prosecution, then that would be a decision that some other administration could make.
Most people have not read the report, but do you think the written report, in a sense, did a better job, if people read it, than Mueller did in explaining it?
If you read the entire 448 pages, you cannot come away with anything but an enormous impression that there was a welcoming attitude towards Russian interference. And by the way, let's stop and go back just for a moment here to square one.
Right.
If you were just dropping as someone who Rip Van Winkled into this moment in history, you would be astonished at how little is being said about the Mueller report and everything that he said yesterday on the subject of Russian interference. Mm-hmm. This is something the president has called a hoax. He has said it never happened. It clearly happened, and it is documented in this report extensively. And that should probably have been the focus from the very beginning. But because we are fascinated as a nation and certainly in the media with the personality of Donald Trump, this has all gone to a question of whether or not this is going to be Watergate, whether or not it's going to be impeachment, whether or not it's going to be Bill Clinton's impeachment. And whether it is or not, and at this moment it appears that it will not be, there is an enormous pachyderm in the room, and that is the fact that the Russians not only interfered in 2016, but they got away with it, and they're doing it again in 2020, which Robert Mueller, the man who was supposed to save us after 9/11, knows a little bit about international affairs, a little bit about international meddling, interference in American affairs, said this is one of the most serious challenges the United States has ever experienced to its national security, and it's happening, quote, while we sit here.
Well, let me play, and this is from yesterday, Representative Peter Welch, he's a Democrat from Vermont, discussing the fact that during the 2016 campaign, Trump officials did not tell the FBI that they had been approached by Russian contacts and offered dirt on their political opponent. Let's give it a listen.
But I ask if you share my concern. And my concern is, have we established a new normal from this past campaign that is going to apply to future campaigns, so that if any one of us running for the U.S. House, any candidate for the U.S. Senate, any candidate for the presidency of the United States, aware that a hostile foreign power is trying to influence an election, has no duty to report that to the FBI or other authorities?
Well, I hope.
Go ahead.
I hope this is not the new normal, but I fear it is.
Ron, I was just curious about why the Republicans focus largely on the Steele dossier and Stroke and Page and other what appeared to be slightly tangential issues, and not so much on the fact that the Russians really interfered with the 2016 election. The intelligence community said that several years ago.
The Republican Party has decided that it will stand behind Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has said that none of these things were done to help him and that he did not need any help and that they had nothing to do with his victory in 2016. That has been a consistent position on the part of the president in the face of all evidence, in the face of our intelligence community's unanimous conclusion that the Russians did interfere and that they interfered on behalf of Donald Trump. Not that they were necessarily coordinating their efforts, but that that was their intent to defeat Hillary Clinton and that he benefited from it. That is unacceptable to the president because it casts a shadow on his great victory, his great triumph in 2016. And the Republican Party has had to decide whether they were going to accept that and stand behind it and delegitimize all efforts to, in any sense, get to the bottom of what the Russians did, or whether they wanted to take the approach the Republican Party took in Watergate, which was, well, hey, let's find out what went on here. Mm-hmm. Are there serious crimes being committed? Is there, in some sense or another, a threat to the constitutional government that we all swore to uphold? And those Republicans reached the conclusion that they had to be true to the Constitution.
A couple of comments here. One from Will. Even if Mueller concluded Trump committed crimes, he would still not have indicted without Trump being impeached. So I'm left thinking this was a whole lot to do about nothing. Annabelle says it was a mess. The entire day was a mess. Ron, what happens next? And it seemed yesterday Nancy Pelosi and others had a press conference basically saying that they're going to go ahead with their various investigations, but not impeachment.
They do not want to commence a formal impeachment proceeding at this point, even though the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, whom we saw yesterday, Jerry Nadler from New York, is ready to do so. He wants to do so. He has asked to do so. Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the leadership, although they obviously are ambivalent about this, think that it is not the time. Now, there are two factors here. One is that the American people are not, in some sense or another, demanding it. They weren't demanding it in the case of Watergate either. Mm-hmm. And in another sense, there is a futility in going through this proceeding in the House, even though formally it would be the way to make clear how they feel about all of this. If you know you're not going to even get so much as a prayer of a conviction in the Senate. And that has been made manifestly clear. Just let me say that yesterday, several bills to try to shore up the security of our election system in 2020 in the wake of Mueller's report and then his testimony were blocked on the Senate floor. Wow. They were blocked on the Senate floor because the Republican leadership does not even want them to be discussed or considered.
Ron, we're almost out of time here. So is this the end of the Mueller report? Are we done?
The Mueller report will always be there. Mueller's testimony will always be there. I don't think we're going to see much more of Robert Mueller.
Well, on that note, Ron Elving, as always, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR and joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, talking about yesterday's testimony by Robert Mueller. Well, coming up after this very short break, I'll be talking with Harriet Washington about her new book. It's called A Terrible Thing to Waste, about how environmental toxins disproportionately harm marginalized communities of color. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Industrial waste, air pollution, poor sanitation, and other environmental hazards disproportionately affect marginalized communities of color. In fact, African Americans, Native Americans, and Latinos have greater exposure to things like lead and arsenic, PCBs, pesticides, and other toxic chemicals, as well as dangerous microbes, and that's compared to whites. Our guest science writer, Harriet Washington, is the author of a new book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind, about how this happened, the price it's been paid, and what to do to address the problem. She takes on IQ tests that show a black-white racial gap and challenges the notion that intelligence is forever fixed and strictly inherited. Rather, she writes that the stew of toxic chemicals found in many minority communities impairs cognitive development and negatively impacts behavior, health, and longevity. As I mentioned, she's a science writer. She's also a medical ethicist and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Harriet Washington, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. I'm really happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, here are a bunch of ways you can join our conversation. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me begin with kind of a broad question. Why are we more likely to find these toxic threats, these toxic dangers in minority communities?
There is a wide swathe of racially biased practices in this country that have forced minority communities to living in proximity to these toxic hazards. Essentially, they have become the course of least resistance for corporate polluters as well as governments seeking to evade responsibility. And as a recent 2016 report shows, this confluence of biases forces them into these geographical areas, and actually many plants that emit these noxious fumes and these heavy metals that are poisonous decide to locate in areas where minority group people live. Some of the many factors include the fact that redlining and racial bias lowers the rate of home ownership. When you don't own your own home, you have less clout in terms of helping to make the laws or govern what you're going to be exposed to. And there's also the case that locating near minority communities is, interestingly, it's predicated on race rather than socioeconomics. Hmm. If you look at the economic situation, African Americans who are solidly middle class, often live in the suburbs, have average incomes of $50,000, $60,000, are much, much more likely to be exposed to noxious chemicals than are very poor whites with an average income of $10,000. So despite the fact that it's often characterized as a socioeconomic problem, poverty is a factor. Race is a much more powerful factor.
What about NIMBY? I mean, I'm thinking about neighborhoods. They often are wealthier neighborhoods who say, well, not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard.
You're not going to put your chemical factory here or your highway.
Exactly. There's a racial parallel to NIMBYs. Lulus, locally unwanted land uses.
Lulu.
Yes.
I didn't know.
So ways in which people don't want their land used relegated to African-American communities. There's also a lot of criminal activity. For example, the environmental justice move has started in cities like Afton, North Carolina. The people living there were the victims of criminal corporate owners from New York who drove trucks all the way from New York to North Carolina under cover of darkness to dump poisoned oil along the roadsides rather than pay to have it disposed of legally. And when that happened, North Carolina decided we're going to move all this poisoned land soil to Afton, where African Americans live. And the African people said, we know why you're dumping it here, because we're black. You think we will lie down? And they didn't. They had old-fashioned civil rights protests where they had signs and T-shirts saying no PCBs. They fought it. The response of local law enforcement was to call out the sheriff and arrest them and invoke law and order, even though they were the victims of the criminal conspiracy.
Well, let's talk about Anniston, Alabama. You mentioned PCBs,
right.
And this was essentially a company town, eventually, I guess, owned by Monsanto. And what they did was apparently discharge PCBs into the local creek there. What happened after that?
We're almost never talking about a single entity. So, yes, Anniston was a victim of Monsanto that dumped PCBs, but Anniston was also the site of an army depot that had a wide variety of toxic chemicals that it stored in crumbling facilities and eventually began leaking into the waterways there, never warning the residents of Anniston, who began suffering from this, I call it a post-apocalyptic landscape, where they could no longer plant flowers and vegetables in their gardens because the soil was poisoned. So they now have these huge 55-ton plastic drums where they do their gardening.
Because they can't use their soil.
Because they can't use their soil. Where children can't play in the playgrounds because the soil is tainted. Where one woman I spoke with, a nurse, would tie on a paper mask, not to go into the OR, but to go mow her lawn. because she was aware of the toxic, you know. So we're talking about these poisoned landscapes where I think Aniston is a perfect example of what happens even when you don't get adequate resolutions. Because they mounted numerous lawsuits, one mounted by Johnny Cochran, very successful for a while, opened a healthcare clinic, but eventually the money runs out.
Yeah.
And so now you have communities of people where the children are dying of a disease we think of as a disease of old age. One man I spoke of, David Barker, had his 17-year-old brother died suffering from kidney cancer, brain disease at 17 years old, hardening of the arteries. And these people are all being poisoned. Hmm. When they go to town meetings about their situations, everybody there knows their internal PCB level. They know to say, I've got 17 parts per billion, whatever. So it's because part of their life. It's constricted their life. And there's so many horrible things about it that I have to stop talking now.
Well,
but I think it's really a good example of what happens when we don't address the problem.
Well, here's another horrible thing. There was a settlement, something like $142 million settlement. But when it was divvied up among all the residents, adults got $9,000 and children got $2,000.
Right. I wrote about that when I said that they had a lawsuit. That was the one that Johnny Cochran was able to get. And at first they were jubilant. They thought that the money they would receive would actually change the course of their lives, allow them to, among other things, leave the area. Because victims can't leave the area. Who wants to buy a house that's sitting on basically sludge and sewage and, you know, toxic poisons? So, but it didn't. After the lawyers got their share, which is, you know, as we know, routine, there was not enough money to really address the problem. A few thousand dollars for children who have a lifelong disability based on this. So I think it's indicative, among other things, of how wrong-headed the idea of invoking personal responsibility is. A person in Aniston can absolutely do almost nothing about his situation. We need the government to step in and stop corporate polluters.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Harriet Washington, our guest. And again, she's got a new book. It's titled A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. And we'll be talking about IQ testing, because that's certainly a part of this discussion. You can join us. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's talk about lead. We know about Flint, Michigan, and the problems of lead in the water. That's been certainly discussed and highlighted. I don't think it's been entirely fixed, but at least there's been some effort to address that problem. Here in Philadelphia, in an old city, the lead tends to be in paint, and that can be a hazard to children and probably to adults as well. But the whole, I remember when they took lead out of gasoline. I mean, what a big deal that was. And it actually had an impact on people's behavior.
Exactly. Murder rates dropped when lead was taken out of gasoline.
And you can see that, right?
Exactly.
You can see the graphs.
That's well documented. Kevin Drum has written some pieces in Mother Jones that are completely illuminating about that. However, they skyrocketed back up when it began being used in paint. And the lead industry has been notoriously deft at manipulating the government and in silencing opposition to the use of its poisonous products, which it knew to be poisonous but lied to consumers about.
Well, and what is the effect of lead then on children's development, on things like brain development?
As you noted, it affects adults as well. But children are uniquely vulnerable. They have this exquisite vulnerability because a fetus's or a very young child's brain, between conception and 18 months of age, the child basically builds a brain, which is very complex, and there are windows of vulnerability. At certain days, certain structures have to either migrate or develop, and if you're unfortunate enough to have an exposure on those days, it can completely distort your brain. Lifelong disability. If you have an exposure a week later, it might not affect you. So children, there are a number of reasons why children are more vulnerable, but the developing brain, I think, is number one. Also, the fact that children have more surface volume area as opposed to adults, and a lot of poisoning is through skin contact. They inhale more air compared to adults, and so inhalation poisoning, air pollution, the number one killer, by the way. And so children are uniquely vulnerable. And I write in the book a great deal about the behavioral problems and the loss of intelligence. But I think the loss of intelligence is something that has been distorted by our almost fetishistic embracing of IQ and a misunderstanding promulgated by some scientists called hereditarians about what IQ really is and isn't, what it can and cannot measure.
Well, let's get into that because, I mean, the beginning of the book is really about the IQ test, the Stanford-Binet, other tests that have been used as well. There is this IQ gap. So how are we supposed to sort of understand what that gap means?
Yeah. Well, if you know what IQ means, then you understand better what the IQ gap means. We're told by hereditarians, these scientists who have strong policy implications tied with their beliefs, we're told that IQ represents a genetic, racial, intelligence, so that one receives one's IQ from one's parents and it's racially stratified. We're told that IQ never changes, and we're told IQ represents the potential for intelligence. You'll never have more intelligence than your IQ dictates. All of these beliefs are wrong. IQ is not genetic. We have a lot of evidence for that, and it indeed changes within individuals' lives and populations' lives. James Flynn wrote a book that detailed how in the U.S., other Western countries as well, we've been seeing a 3-point IQ rise every decade. Does that mean people are getting innately smarter?
Hmm.
No, it means that people are getting better educated. What IQ represents is what one has learned. Okay, it doesn't represent one's potential for learning. And even in Kenya, they looked at one area of Kenya and found a 14-point rise in IQ. Was there any change in the genetics of the people there? No. There was a change in their health. Better nutrition, and especially eradicating some pathogens, cause IQs to rise. So if you look at what IQ actually does measure, that makes it a useful tool, because if you look at what it's purported to measure, it's completely biased. In fact, one really important researcher in intelligence points out that comparing IQs between different countries and different groups is meaningless. Unless you have completely equivalent societies where you're valuing the same things as being intelligent, and where everyone is literate, where you have adequate nutrition, then you're actually measuring some impossible to sort out, you know, mixture of opportunity and nutrition and health, you know. So the bottom line is that if you understand what IQ actually is, it's useful. Mm. If you don't know what it is, you're basically buying into a very racist bias system.
Well, even race is a construct. You can't put race under a microscope and decide what color someone is.
It's not biological, but it is social.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the catch. Because sometimes race is a social entity, you end up with health consequences. This is a perfect example. You know, we have a health consequence here. We have people who are much more likely to grow up abutting sources of very, you know, strong toxins. And so that is going to affect their health, it's going to affect their behavior, it's going to affect their cognition. Not because there's something innately about them, but any people who are put in that situation would show the same deficits.
You call that fence line zones. I mean, the people sort of living, as you say, abutting up to,
right,
let's say, a chemical factory, something like that.
Exactly, exactly. And many more African Americans and Hispanics and other people. And, of course, Native Americans are a special case because most Native Americans don't live on the reservation. But the reservations are probably, might be the worst, you know, the worst communities in terms of being buffeted by not only toxic substances and polluted water, but also deficiencies.
Mm. Have you looked at toxic stress? That's something that's been talked about in Philadelphia here, where children growing up in violent neighborhoods, in a sense, kind of a war zone, that can also affect their development. There are even schools and teachers that are using our understanding of toxic stress to help children learn in the classroom.
Briefly, but it pales compared to environmental exposures to poisons. It's an important factor. And, you know, there are other theories of stress as well. There's actually one that I write about in more detail toward the end of the book, and because I think it's useful to dwell on possible solutions. And stress, of course, is not always a bad thing. It's certainly a bad thing in the situation that you described.
Right.
But I think that we have to understand that some of the theories of stress, especially in Europe, they're promulgated, talk about the fact that exposure to the natural environment gives one sort of a partial inoculation to stress. And it's very important for children's development. Children who grow up with knowledge and interaction with the natural environment tend to be happier children and tend to be healthier children.
But if that natural environment is a dangerous place, you're always sort of on, ready to fight or flight.
But the natural environment is not a dangerous place. It's the environment that we have created with our chemicals, because especially in the U.S., we have these over 160,000 chemicals, 60,000 in current use, that have never been tested for health effects. Mm. So we have turned the natural environment into a very toxic place. So the natural environment can be found in our country in areas that various environmental groups like the Sierra Club is trying to keep clean. You know, wild should wild remain. That's an important message for African Americans as anybody else. There's this myth, an interesting myth, that African Americans are not really interested in interacting with the natural environment. But that's actually the culmination of racial bias as well, because people tend to forget that during segregation, which did not officially end legal segregation that long ago, African Americans were frankly barred from. They were not allowed into some parks. You know, they were not allowed into swimming pools. They were not allowed into many wild areas. And today, Robert Bullard tells us that his studies show that African Americans now are in a situation where there's no good public transit to these places. So people who might want to go and visit national parks can't actually get there.
Hmm. So, well, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Harriet A. Washington is our guest. She's a science writer. She's also a medical ethicist. And her new book is called A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. She wrote a book a number of years ago, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. We'll be talking more about the problem and also the solution after this very short break. So do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Harriet Washington about her new book, A Terrible Thing to Waste. It's about how environmental toxins disproportionately harm marginalized communities of color, affecting things like cognitive development, behavior, overall health, even longevity. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Maureen. She says, can your guest speak about the problem that people of color have in the rental market regarding substandard housing that leads to health problems? You're nodding your head.
Yes, very important problem. I'm thinking immediately of Baltimore. Inability to own one's home strictly curtails your remedies and your voice even in maintaining the health of your community, including maintaining freedom from toxic exposures. But it's even worse than that. In Baltimore, I write about a horrible case in which Kennedy Cugar Institute, which was devoted to maintaining the health of children who have disabilities and health challenges, had actually been engaged in a study that even though it was approved by Johns Hopkins IRB, was ethically troubled. They essentially recruited landlords, encouraged landlords to rent families with young children. They wanted families with young children in the housing because they knew that the housing had lead in it. And they were trying to test various methods of removing most, not all, of the lead from the housing, even though the CDC has stipulated that only total lead removal will maintain a kid's health. They were using the blood levels of the children in this housing to titrate to determine how well the lead was being taken from the housing.
When was this?
This happened, I don't remember the exact dates, but it was going on in the early 1990s. We're not talking about the distant past here. So basically, they were taken to court by the mothers of the children. I should say the parents of the children. Fathers are involved too.
Mm-hmm.
They were taken to court, and they lost, and the parents lost. But in the appeal, the Maryland Court of Appeals roundly condemned the study. They said it's like Tuskegee.
I was going to say, kids, sounds like Tuskegee.
These kids are being used like children in the coal mines, you know, canaries in the coal mines. And, you know, using the bodies of the kids to determine how well the lead is being taken out. And it's incredibly offensive. It's incredibly abusive. And it speaks to the vulnerability of people in rental housing. You're at the mercy of the landlord to maintain the housing in an appropriate state to live in, and many landlords simply will not abate the lead. It's expensive. So I think that's only a few of the ways in which being barred from home ownership.
Let's talk about asthma, just how serious a problem that is. And is that also related to some of these housing situations?
It's related to housing because the vermin in housing, we know that roaches and roach parts contribute to asthma. We know that having rodents in housing contributes to hantavirus that causes lung function problems. Both of these conditions cause hypoxia, the temporary loss of oxygen to the brain. When you have repeated bouts of hypoxia, you lose cognitive ability. It can actually reduce your intelligence, reduce your IQ.
Because you're struggling to breathe.
Right. So living in this housing actually reduces people's cognition, affects their brains as well as their bodies. So it's a very good point.
Does it also affect school attendance, that if a child is struggling with asthma, they might not go to school as regularly as other children?
It affects a great deal of things physically that we're really well aware of. But I think the news, at least for me, was how common hypoxia is and how directly it affects the brain and cognition. But you're right. School attendance, behavior, any number of ways. Asthma is harmful, not to mention the fact that people assume that children grow out of asthma. Not really. Not all the time. Newscaster Harold Dow died of asthma. So adults die of asthma as well. You don't always outgrow it.
Here's a comment from Petra. If these companies, we were talking about companies earlier, are responsible for making people sick with their toxic waste, they should be financially responsible for relocating the families they've affected. In a perfect world, that would happen, yes?
I agree. In a really perfect world, these companies would never have the opportunity to poison communities because we in the U.S. would do what they do in the European Union. In the EU, you can't market a chemical without doing human tests first. In this country, we only test after people have been harmed. And then the testing tends to be very prolonged and very expensive and not very effective. So, yes, we as a nation have failed to take these corporate entities to task. We also are guilty as a nation because the EPA has rolling back laws. We don't have enough protection for citizenry.
Well, and that would be even truer under President Trump, who is rolling back many of the EPA regulations.
Yeah, well, it began with President Trump, frankly. I mean, there were a lot of Obama-era and earlier legislation, including Nixon. Nixon was actually very effective in terms of—
Well, he helped to found the EPA,
exactly,
correct?
Exactly. So until Trump came along, we were making progress. But when Trump came along, that ended because he has not only revoked a lot of earlier laws just a few days ago— He revoked a rule saying that there had to be surprise inspections. Now we're going to notify every time we do an inspection, which, of course, is going to make it less efficient. So I could give you more and more examples, but it's easy to find for yourself that we have had a lot of rollback rather than the kind of progress that we need.
Here's a headline from the EPA from just a week or so ago. From the New York Times, EPA won't ban pyrifos, a pesticide tied to children's health problems.
Exactly. One of the chemicals that was wreaking havoc, I believe, in Dunbar as well as Anniston. Yeah.
You also, I want to talk about some of the suggestions that you have. And one of the things that you write about is that when iodine has been added to salt, it does raise IQ points. Help us understand that.
I think that's important because hereditarian scientists who claim that IQ is racial and genetic, this finding has belied what they say. They say that there's no point in trying to raise IQs because they can't be raised. So that pre-K programs and Head Start are quixotic, futile wastes of money and irresponsible use of funds. But in 1924, we took the same IQ gap, 15 points, and we closed it. We closed it in one generation. We closed it by spending $2 or $3 literally per ton. And all we did was we added potassium iodide to salt.
Hmm.
And immediately, people from low IQ areas of the country, 15 points lower on average, found their IQs mirrored that of the rest of the country. Iodine and salt cured this mental retardation, this deficiency. And it did it because iodide turns out to be a necessary component of thyroxin, thyroid hormone, which is needed to build a healthy brain. So very clearly, we saw the same 15-point gap disappear when we did the simple, cheap step. And yet, iodine deficiency remains the most important source of mental retardation on the planet.
Hmm.
So we have information, but we're not using it. And that illustration that the IQ gap was closed by a simple environmental step is something that we need to take to heart and look for others instead of giving into futility.
You talk about the people who believe that IQ is fixed, it's hereditary, it's never going to change. Whatever you're born with, that's what you're going to die with. But it seems there's so much more research now about intelligence, whether we call it IQ or not. We even talk about intelligences, that certain people are stronger in an emotional intelligence or a physical intelligence or block design intelligence. I mean, there's so many different ways to slice and dice what we mean when we talk about intelligence.
True.
Or even IQ.
But for our purposes, even simpler than that. You're absolutely right. But what's more important is, I think, is that in this country, we tie intelligence to things like literacy mm-hmm. and being able to manipulate numbers. To us, those are crucial features of intelligence because we live in a technological Western community. And that's what we test because that's what's important to us. Is that important in other countries? Is that important in other communities? The people who've done a ranking of IQs in most nations of the world find that people in Ethiopia, in fact, people in every African country have much lower intelligence. All of them have intelligence below 70 except for South Africa. So what are they saying? They're saying that people there are less intelligent. But what's intelligence in those countries? One researcher summed it up really beautifully. He basically said, IQ can tell if you'll be a good office worker. It won't tell if you can be a good farmer. So what's important, what's considered intelligence in these countries is something very different that we are not testing for.
But as we become a more industrialized world or even a world of quote-unquote information, we're going to need to figure out how to be office workers more than, I think, farmers. Not that we're not going to need farmers, but that there's a need for that kind of person.
There's a need here in this country. There's a need in the West. These other countries I'm speaking of, I'm not sure. I think that day might be far afield if it comes at all. We're talking about countries where most people have a very agrarian subsistence existence, mm-hmm. sometimes less than that. And in my opinion, it's just not realistic to worry about preparing them to become office workers, you know, when they can't even find a way to feed themselves. Illiteracy is not required in a lot of these countries, no compulsory education. So for the foreseeable future, we're talking about countries where they have and are going to continue to have very different standards of what constitutes intelligence. And we have to remember, too, that nobody can really define intelligence well. The people I've spoken to have worked really, you know, spent their whole career in their fields, they can't define it. And Shockley, like the grandfather of all hereditarians, when you asked what intelligence was, it was something actually, I don't want to say stupid, but not too clever. He said, intelligence, like electricity, is easier to measure than define.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, any high school student will tell you electricity is easily defined. The flow of charged particles, we know that.
But
he was ignorant of what intelligence really is, but yet he was very clear on saying that black people have less of it than whites.
Well, I don't believe that for one minute. But in the section about iodine, though, you do write that countries with higher IQs have stronger economies and greater wealth.
That's true. we've measured IQ, and we have found that correlation. But look at the countries we're talking about. Those countries were in the West. We're talking about countries in Europe and the U.S. So, and of course, in my book, I focused on our own definition of IQ and intelligence because that's who I'm talking about. But if I were to make, if I were addressing this globally, it'd be a very different book. I actually wrote an article for the American Scholar in which I talked about the role of infectious disease in intelligence in the developing world. And pathogens that are very common there but only now becoming common in this country are responsible for a lot of loss of intelligence there.
Mm. Well, then what to do? And you do have at near the end of the book some suggestions for people to do, especially I would assume if one is living in an area or a neighborhood or a community where there are these toxic threats, what do you suggest, let's say, parents or families, individuals
right.
do?
The most important thing to say, I think, to preface this, is that it's a mistake to put the burden on the people who are being poisoned. In this country, public health used to confront corporations. It used to confront governments and force them to act in ways to improve health. Now there's a lot of focus on personal responsibility, but that's not an appropriate stance here. Because what can one lone individual do? I can't do anything to curb Monsanto's actions. I can't do anything to, you know, change the fact that the bus depots in New York City seem to be concentrated in Harlem. No person can really affect that. The only thing you can hope to do is change things within your own home to mitigate the effects. And so I think I need to preface by saying that. But once your focus is there, what can I do for myself and my family to lower the effects? There are a lot of things that can be done. They're not going to be the solution, but they might make things better. And one of them is air quality. Air quality is very important. So if you can, and many people can't, run your air conditioner and keep your windows closed. Expensive solution, though. Right. Many people can't do that. I'll use HEPA filters, for example. Get rid of vermin and pathogens. Again, a case where being a renter makes it more difficult than a homeowner. In the end, you're dependent on your landlord to do the right thing, but I point out that laws protect you, so you may be able to use that as leverage for your landlord. You know, I don't want to report you to OSHA, or I don't want to report you to whatever environmental agency, so please do something about this vermin. So do what you can to get rid of the vermin, and also food preparation and nutrition is really important. I think, nutrition, I talk about food swamps. And how in many urban areas where Black people and Hispanic people live, it's very difficult to buy nutritious food. It's overpriced. There aren't any supermarkets. And it's coupled with the fact you've got potent, high-alcohol drinks are being marketed there that aren't marketed elsewhere. You know, malt liquor, things like that. And tobacco.
And cigarette, Lucy's, things like that.
Exactly. So the availability of those things also worsens exposure. Nutrition, for example, good nutrition will partly, and I have to stress, partly protect you against lead exposure because having calcium and other electrolytes can actually block its lodging in the bone. So nutrition among prenatal nutrition is really important. A lot of people don't know that folic acid will prevent a lot of neurological problems in children, and a lot of people don't know that eating fish is problematic. I mean, fish is good for your child's brain, and yet some fish hold a lot of mercury. And studies have shown, the problem with studies is that they don't all agree, but some studies have shown that despite the mercury, a woman is still better at eating a lot of fish. So I talk about those things. And filtering your water.
Sure.
But again, they're all expensive.
Well, and you also say, and we're out of time here, but enroll your child in pre-K.
Exactly. Most important, pre-K programs.
Well, we're going to end on that note. And Harriet Washington, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And again, her book is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. And she's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.